Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with Justin Lucero, who is making his directorial debut by directing the production of The Liar for the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training. Justin's story is the story of a man who, however knocked off course he was, and he was several times, continues to resurrect himself as the person he was always meant to be, and that is a director. You will hear Justin say in the beginning of the interview that he was always bossy. And I tell him that I hear this from a lot of people who wound up being directors. Justin's story is wonderful because it continues to make the point that we are capable of knowing who we are, and we are capable of pursuing it, even when things happen which seem to be pointing us in an opposite direction. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are. It's about having the permission to be aware of who you really are. Not, as I quite often say, the person you think you're supposed to be, or the person you think a good person is, or the person that other people told you you had to be or ought to be. There are so many messages to us about what we must or should or ought to be. But in fact, there is an us. There is a you. There is the person who, if you were given the support and encouragement to simply explore and express yourself, that's the person you would be. And it is unfortunate and clear to me as a therapist that so many of us don't get that encouragement, that nourishment. And as a result, we wind up hiding aspects of ourselves, pretending to be other than we are, and losing access to the very basic, very essential beings that we would naturally be. and as a therapist, I spend a lot of time trying to help people figure out what they might have denied, what they might have lost access to, and helping them recover it. Because not only is it energy consuming to be pretending to be other than you are, even if you're not aware of it, and recovering yourself frees up all this energy, it's just easier, more pleasant, more delightful to be the person you are. But I am also aware that it is not so simple as figuring out, oh yes, I denied this quality, this aspect, this interest, this passion. Let me go get it back. I'm sorry, it's not that easy. Because for whatever reason you denied it, when you start to try and recover it, the reason comes back. And it was never a frivolous reason. There was always a good reason. So that's the work of therapy. And if you're curious about that, interested in that, want to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow, thelynshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. You can click on the email tab and ask me any questions that you have. Get me to come and speak to your group or organization. Get a copy of my book. Listen to the first chapter of my book, which is up there. And listen to all the shows I've ever done and all the interviews I've ever done, including the one I'm about to air with Justin Lucero. You might notice that I'm speaking very quickly. That's because this interview is long and I really didn't want to cut any of it because it makes the point so clearly that it is possible to know yourself and to find yourself and to be yourself. And you can hear the pleasure, the joy, the energy, the passion in Justin. So I don't want to say another word except here now is Justin Lucero. Okay, I'm here with Justin Lucero, and Justin is here directing The Liar for the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training production. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And so I'm making the huge leap that the art to which you would like to give your life, make your living, is directing?
Correct.
Okay, good. And I only ask one question. Do you remember the very first moment in your life when acting, stories, directing, telling people what to do, any of that called you, compelled you, became interesting to you? What, if anything, sparked this in you?
I don't think I ever recognized it while it was happening. I think now, in hindsight, I'm able to kind of pinpoint some events. I would say really generically and crudely that I was very inspired by television, mm-hmm. and specifically Disney cartoons. I always found it fascinating how people could tell stories in nonsensical ways, and I always thought it was fun to watch how people's creative minds worked and how they can captivate people's attention so vividly. But then also as a child, I just naturally was the bossy one. I was always the one that, you know, gathered the friends together and assigned, you know, you do this, you do that. And, you know, I've always been the one that said, it would be better if we did it this way. And people would respond to it. It was never really a contest. It always was a kind of natural falling into place type of thing. But I grew up in a household that wasn't very exposed to the arts. My mother had dabbled in singing, as some of her siblings had, so there was a love for music that I grew up around, but we never went to concerts or theater, rarely went to the cinema. And I remember when my mom, out of the blue, got us tickets to a national touring production of The Sound of Music.
How old were you when she got you the tickets?
It was elementary school. It was like 8 or 10.
You said some really interesting things. Mm-hmm. The idea that stories could be told in a kind of nonsensical or fantastic, yes, way, which was what cartoons were, that's a very sophisticated thought. You weren't having that thought when you were a little boy. Or were you? I don't know.
I kind of feel like it wasn't that developed, obviously, of a concept, but I did, for some reason, recognize that I was more interested in animation and putting song in a story and funny rhymes and colorful approaches to things.
Yeah, so it was less about the content for you and more about the production.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah, that's very unusual, I think, especially for a very young child. Mm-hmm. And as you say, of course, at the time, you would not have been thinking in terms of production, right? You would just have been thinking about what you were drawn to, what stood out for you, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've always left, you know, a piece of art, like a movie or a television show or a play, even from a young age, and not just commented on how fun it was or how commented on that was cool. It was always that was cool because did you notice that they blah, blah, blah. And so I've always watched television and movies. As I'm watching it, I could picture the people behind the scenes making it happen. Or my imagination would just start thinking about the person who had their pencil to paper making that figure. Or watching a production that had music and seeing in my mind the studio with the instrumentalists and the little conductor, you know, making that happen. It's so bizarre. I'm never able to just escape. I'm always...
You're always analyzing.
The cogs are turning everything. Today I go to theater a lot and I can't just ever watch it. I'm always thinking about every single aspect of it. And I start to realize that when I do find moments of being lost, that's when I really think, wow, they did a great job.
Yes. Right, they did it.
They got you.
right, I got it. So this is really interesting. The idea that it was like a crash course for you. Everything you watched was teaching you something. You were, you wanted to know how it got done,
right?
And from what you say, you were even imagining how it got done.
Yeah.
Right? That's pretty amazing. And the other thing about you being the bossy one, you know, I've heard this before from people who wind up being directors, you know, that they start out being directors in some ways. So you said, you know, I was the one who said we should do this and we should do it that way and you should do this. But what was it that they were doing that you were directing them in?
Childhood games. It was out in the yard. It was very simple. We didn't have much. And so it was out in the yard and we had maybe a broom and some board game. And I would never use the board game the way it was intended. It was the stereotypical grandma says, go outside for an hour. I'm sick of having you inside. And they would look around at me to see, well, then what are we going to do? And I'd have to come up with something. I didn't really have to focus on schoolwork. I was done always on time. And so I always had the flexibility to just...
So you were smart, too. But in addition to that, you were inventing from day one, apparently.
Yeah. And I never recognized that in myself until years, decades later.
Well, we'll get there. Yeah. We'll get there. So here already, you're behaving as an artist. You're behaving as a director. You're already enmeshed in this thing, that the creation of art, the telling of stories, all that stuff, right? Okay, so then at 8, your mother spontaneously gets tickets to Sound of Music.
Sound of Music, a play version. And she knew that I was familiar with the film. I don't know if it was obsessed, but I was definitely inspired and influenced even then with Julie Andrews and that production and those songs and the fantasy of this story. And
she knew it.
She also knew that I had never been to one before.
Yes.
And there was something about it that she bought tickets, and she only bought tickets for herself and me and my sister. Not my dad, not my brother, no one else. I guess she also saw that they wouldn't be that interested in something like that, but for some reason I would be. And I went, had never been in a theater before. Didn't know what she was doing. I mean, she even explained I got tickets to something and I didn't know what that meant. But we watched it and the whole time I had a grin on my face, but I was also criticizing anytime something wasn't identical to the way it was in the movie. So they would do things and I would think, oh, that was cool. They did it. They did the same thing, but they did it a little differently and they had to memorize all of that. But then they would do something radically different, and I'd think, oh, I don't like that at all. Why did they change that? No. But I remember that just being fascinating, that a movie could be done live. And I really really am truly honest when I say I had no idea that that was even a thing, that theater was a thing. I know that I had seen dramas at church, you know, the Easter or the Christmas play, but I just thought that that was more glorified version of a sermon or something. Mm-hmm. I never saw the link of what I was doing with the kids in the yard as a kind of playing, performing.
Right.
It was just, that was completely different from doing it for people. I just didn't understand that. And then when I saw this production, I remember feeling so wowed and shocked in a positive way that this was a legitimate form of something. I didn't even know what that meant, but it was awesome.
Well, it was an option that you didn't previously have.
Yeah.
And clearly a pivotal moment that, oh my God, this exists.
Right.
And I like this.
Mm-hmm. Even though I liked it, it didn't turn into anything.
Well, not then.
Not then. I still was not exposed to very much of that, and there wasn't really that outlet in school. I remember vividly that when you got into fifth grade, they did a Christmas production, and everyone was required to be a part of it. The best student in the class got to be the narrator. So I was always one of the best students, and I always wanted to be the best student. So I thought, I will be the narrator of this play. So we were going to do a Wizard of Oz-themed Christmas show. Dorothy returns back in Oz for Christmas, for some reason. And I was assigned the narrator part, and I was just so excited. And I guess because I was the narrator, I was in the script every day in rehearsal, and very quickly memorized everybody's parts, so I knew everybody's lines. And it came time to perform for the families, and the girl who was assigned the part of the Wicked Witch was notorious for always being absent at school. Ooh. Always being absent at school. And lo and behold, she was absent on the day that we were performing. And I mean, to this day, her name is ingrained in my brain. Her name was Shannon, and she was never at school. And the teacher made the quick decision that, well, it's easy to have someone stand at the podium and narrate with the book in hand.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. And we have someone who has all the lines memorized. So my very first ever stage experience was being forced to put on a Wicked Witch costume and wig and go on stage and perform the role of the Wicked Witch.
Oh my
when
God.
All my heart wanted to do was be the narrator. And so I did it. And they got two girls to replace the one me as the narrator. And so I went and I performed. And the climax of the production is the Cowardly Lion gains his bravery and pushes the Wicked Witch down to rescue, I don't know what, Christmas or Dorothy. And I flail and fall to the floor, and there's uproarious laughter. And I just cannot register why they're laughing. And it's just so, and I'm, you know, I'm the good little natural actor, I suppose, so that I stay there until it like lulls, but it doesn't. I'm in fifth grade and I'm like, why are they quiet? So I pick my head up to peek to see what's going on, and 5 feet in front of me is my wig. And everyone's laughing at me because my wig fell, and I remember distinctly people in the audience saying, that's not Shannon. And from then on, I was so scarred that I never, ever did theater again.
Oh!
I did not do theater in middle school, in high school, in college.
Oh! What a crime!
All because of Shannon.
Yes! Well, or the teacher.
Well, yeah.
Right.
But there's few things in my memory that are as vivid as that right. moment. So at the end of the year, they had a concert to recruit the next year's band students. My rival, who was not the narrator because she was super smart, skipped fifth grade and went to sixth grade. The band director made a giant deal out of the winner for outstanding band student is our only saxophone player, Desiree. I'm going to have her perform a little bit, and she just kept gushing after this Desiree, and I was just, oh, she skipped a grade, and now she's winning these awards or whatever. And it was at that concert that I vowed, I'm going to be in band, and I'm going to play saxophone so that I can be better than her. So the next year, I joined band, and my mom was very pleased because, like I said, she was interested in music. Mm-hmm. And she had always secretly hoped I would play the piano. Then my mom and dad tried to convince me to play the trumpet. And I said, no, it will be the saxophone. They could not figure out why I was so adamant to play the saxophone, and it was because of Desiree. Yeah. I wanted to play the saxophone. So I played the saxophone, and it actually became my creative outlet for the next decade. I really did dedicate myself to playing the saxophone all through middle school, high school, and college, and I thought I would become a professional saxophonist mm-hmm. or a band director, and I didn't.
No, well, and now I want to hear it. So, college, does that mean you majored in music?
No. it was time to go to college, and I looked my parents square in the face, and I said, I am going to major in music. And they looked at me back and said, no, you will not. And again, I was amongst my generation, the very first to go to college. I had a lot of pressure on me because I was, like I said, always the best student.
Right.
So when I got into school, I wanted to go to a private school. I did not want to go to a public school because even though I didn't have family members that had gone to college, I had some kind of thing in my mind that public school was less than private school. And so I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know that that meant it was more expensive. I didn't know any of that. I just knew I wanted that. And so I got into a good school, and I told my parents I would be a music major. And because they knew it was so expensive, they said no. And they said, we'd like you to think about doing something in computers. That was literally what they said, something in computers.
Right. And what they were saying, this is code for something that'll make you a living.
Exactly.
Right.
It was. And the good boy that I was
yes.
said, of course, yes, if I'm going to go and it'll make you happy, I'm going to graduate in something in computers. So I remember a project that I had done in high school where a teacher wrote, you know, another triumph of originality. Every time I had a project, it was always way out there compared to others' presentations or projects. And so I had done one project, and he wrote, another triumph of originality. Have you ever considered a career in marketing? And that was really the only non-music-related thing that I had ever been told about.
Right.
So I declared myself a marketing major. And the school that I went to was the very first ever accredited business school to offer an e-business degree. And I thought, well, that's computers.
That's right.
So I'm going to do that. I didn't own a computer. I didn't have an email address.
Oh my God.
Didn't really know what it was, but my parents said, do something in computers, and I did. And I graduated with a dual degree in marketing and e-business, but I still did music. I took so many music classes, even though I wasn't a declared music major, you know, had a music scholarship that helped get through the marketing and the e-business.
Did you like it?
I didn't.
Oh, gee.
Because I was good at studying,
yeah.
I did very well.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Marketing at least has an aspect of creativity. So any class that was related to advertising or whenever I had to do a presentation in front of people, that's what really bumped my grade point average. Mm-hmm. I joined, you know, like the Marketing Association, the American Marketing Association. I joined other, like, business-related things and won awards for presentations.
An innovation.
Yeah, but not because it was... If it was something related to, like, statistics or
yeah.
finance or accounting.
I just wish you could see his
so
face.
It was so miserable.
When he says his entire face is scrunched when he says these words.
It really was. It really was. There was nothing about it that, and it was so hard for me. It's such an awful thing for me to say in public that I was good at it. And that's always made things difficult for me to choose what I want to do because everything I've ever done, I've done it well.
Yeah, I want to stop you because I think this is a really important point that you seem to be making, and if you're not, I'm going to.
Okay.
And that is that there does seem to be a conventional wisdom that if you're good at something, you should do it.
Right.
And in actual fact, I don't believe that. I believe that you're a very good example of someone who could be good at a lot of things, but who shouldn't necessarily do those things because he's good at them, because they don't speak to him.
Yes, I wish someone would have been able to speak like that
to
me, you know, years ago.
Well, it's part of the conventional wisdom. I don't want to say there aren't a lot of people who know it. It's not rocket science. But few people are really good at a lot of stuff. So they're stuck, essentially, right, with what they're good at. And also, and this is, I think, one of the things that's wrong with our culture, we are really not encouraged as a culture to do what speaks to us.
Right.
We are encouraged to do as your parents were trying to help you to do something to make a living, to do something that has status attached to it, to do the thing you're good at. Okay, so I'm hoping that you didn't give much more than a college education to this. Did you then go out and become a marketing person?
Now here's the thing. I did not.
Oh, good.
But not oh good in what you think. Oh. I graduated and landed a few interviews for marketing and e-business positions, and that's when it hit me like a ton of bricks that, oh my, I do not want to dedicate my life to this. Mm. So I returned home, and I was in a panic because student loans were starting to needing to be their first payments and all that stuff. And I graduated with that marketing e-business degree, but it was actually an international marketing degree. I pushed myself to get this extra attachment to the degree that part of the requirements were that I minored in a foreign language. And in high school, I had taken German for a few years and loved it. And in college, I took it for fun. I continued, you know, to do German for fun. And part of my marketing training was a summer in Germany. And then while I was there, I was the only person in our class that spoke any German. So when we visited a company, I spoke to the CEO of the company in German, and he was so impressed that he offered me a job on the spot for the following summer as an intern for 3 months with a company car and a company apartment and 10 euros an hour and all this stuff. And I thought, wow, that's great, you know. So I studied in Germany that summer and then came back the following summer. And then when I graduated and landed those interviews and hated the idea of doing business, and got home, it just so happened that my aunt, I think, forwarded me a position from the local school district that was looking for an elementary school German teacher. I had never in my life thought that I would become a teacher.
I was not trained
as a teacher.
When did they start teaching language in elementary
school? Exactly. So when I went to this interview, they explained to me, we are a pioneering foreign language magnet school. It was on the border. All students from kindergarten through eighth grade would take all of their courses in Spanish and English. So half of the classes were in English, half of the classes were in Spanish. So they would actually learn things like math and science in Spanish. They wouldn't learn Spanish for the sake of learning Spanish. They would learn it, the content area in the language.
They'd have to be speaking it.
Right.
Right.
But then 10% of their day was dedicated to a third language. And so this school offered Japanese, Chinese, Russian, and German.
My goodness.
From kindergarten through eighth grade, every student would, the idea was by the end of eighth grade, they would be trilingual.
Right.
And their German teacher had left. The school year had already begun. And so I went to this interview, and this particular principal had a bias to straight out of college young energy. And even though I didn't have a certificate to teach, she saw my credentials, you know, my academics and my language skills, and knew that I would be right. So she hired me. And
she was somewhat forward-thinking. That whole environment was not
totally
rigidly bound, right?
Not at all.
Right.
And so I became a German teacher out of college. And, of course, never thought that that would ever happen. You know, I had to get alternatively certified. So, you know, the nights and the weekends, I had to get my certificate. I had just spent all this time at school. But there was something about it that I just adored.
Yeah, it's performing.
It is performing. I'm so glad you get it. When you teach a foreign language, mm-hmm. I remember the philosophy was immersion. So first day of class, the kindergarten students come in, and I would have to act. They would totally believe that I knew nothing but German. I would never speak a word of English or Spanish. I would sit down and the first day was acting and flailing my arms all over the place and pointing to things and, you know, extending my arm and saying, Guten Morgen. And they would say, Guten Morgen. And I'd point to myself and say, Herr Lucero. And they would say, Herr Lucero. And so the whole year would be them acquiring the language just through my acting.
It's amazing.
I didn't know then that it was what I had always wanted to do.
Yeah.
And
damn Shannon.
I, Shannon. And I remember one of my favorite stories is at the end of the year, the kindergarten students put on a performance to show what they learned in German class to the parents, and we had learned some songs, and I am addressing the audience to introduce the students.
In English.
In English. And I said, good morning, welcome to my class, and all 22 of my students gasped and went, oh, Herr Lucero speaks English. And they were totally mind blown. I mean, it was so funny because I would be in the mall, I'd be at Walmart, I'd be wherever, and I just hear people, you know, across the way saying, Herr Lucero, guten Morgen, and they just, because I didn't speak anything but German, so they would feel so proud to speak German to me.
Brilliant. It is a brilliant concept.
It really was. The school was so great. But part of my duties were these little productions. I would always have to have little showcases for the language, and the Japanese teacher, Chinese teacher, Russian teacher, they would do poetry, or they would read an essay, or they would do little back and forth conversations to show what the students would do. But Mr. Lucero, or Herr Lucero, would do a lip sync performance of Mozart's The Magic Flute. So my students would learn the words to this German opera and they would have to perform it.
Oh.
Or I did The Sound of Music, actually, full circle. I had each of my classes learn a song from The Sound of Music
in German
and perform it as a through storyline where I kind of played the Fräulein Maria character. So I would have each scene happen, and the principal was just so, you know, pleased with my little shows. They weren't just, you know,
invited to the class. No, it's back to innovation.
It really, I mean, I had so much fun doing this kind of thing. And that's when things started to turn.
Mm-hmm.
That's when things started to turn. My best friend declared herself a theater major. And that's finally the first time that I would go to plays to support her. Even all through college, I still had not gone to plays. I had not gone to theater. I had not gone to anything. I'd gone to the odd opera when they would take, you know, students to the education night or whatever. But I had never still, to that day, gone to the theater. And I remember seeing an advertisement in the paper for auditions for Beauty and the Beast at the local dinner theater. And I begged my best friend, the theater major, you must audition. You absolutely should audition for this show. And she's like, I don't know. And I said, look, if you go, I'll go too. I really, honestly did not mean that. So I showed up to the audition to support her because I really thought, oh, this would be so cool. And she stood me up. There were hundreds of people at this place. And I thought, well, I'll audition.
I'm here.
I had never auditioned before for anything in my life. Didn't even know what it was. And I remember being so scared that I would be completely embarrassed.
Sure, humiliated. That was your early experience.
That really was. I had never even put that together. They put us in a room and they warmed us all up. But I had a background in music. So when she would do her scales or when she would say, okay, now do triads or now do this arpeggio, I'd never done it with my voice. I'd done it with the saxophone, but I knew all of what she was saying. So people were looking around me like, who is this guy that we'd never seen in auditions before? Mm-hmm. He's never been in a show. We don't know where he's from, but he looks like I was putting on my little, I know what I'm doing face. And then they gave us all a script that we would do a cold reading from. And they said, okay, we'll call you in when we're ready. And this was, to this day, still the record for having the most people attend an audition. There were hundreds of people that wanted to be in the show. And I still felt compelled to stick around, and I did it. And I nailed it. And the reason I nailed it is because growing up, all of the Disney cartoons that I was obsessed with, I read this part exactly like the cartoon. I mean, that's what I had been known for. At parties, I was doing it all the time. I would be singing and producing the voice and sounding exactly like the Disney characters.
Oh,
and know every single mannerism and I knew every single word. And so this Beauty and the Beast thing, people just looked at me and thought, oh, wow.
Really, where did it come from?
And the next day I got a call that I was given the principal role of the clock, Cogsworth the clock.
Oh my God.
And I thought this certainly did not, I mean, I did not think I'd be in it. There were hundreds of people. If anything, maybe some crowd part. I didn't even know what was called ensemble chorus. I mean, I just thought one of those background people. But I got this role of the clock, and I was even more terrified because they gave me all the materials, and I thought, I don't even know what this means. You know, blocking, costume call, fittings, like, foreign words. I mean, it was like German to my students. It was really bizarre that I was just thrown into this thing, and they legitimately thought that I had a background in this.
Oh, God.
And so I came to the first rehearsal, and I'm so blessed that I didn't have another Shannon experience, because the whole time people were duped that I knew what I was doing only because it was Disney. I knew every word, I knew every harmony, I knew every lyric, all the music rehearsals that we started with. People were just like, how does he already know the music? How does he already know every harmony and part? And
this is a gift. This was a gift to you.
I think so.
Absolutely.
And
you were meant to do this. And this is almost the only way it could have happened.
Well, because it was such a positive experience, I got the bug. And this was really late in life. This was mid-20s. And my first real theater experience. And it was not even at the end of the show, not even on before opening night. It was very early in the rehearsal process that it just clicked that, wow, this is combining everything I've ever recognized in myself as what I like. It has music in it. It's cartoons. It's bossy. And it's everyone in the room that has this enthusiasm that I have.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've always been in the room where I was the only one. And here I'm one of many. And it just felt like home. It felt like family. The creativity that I've always saw myself as being my favorite thing. Any approach to school or projects or anything. Just as long as you can be creative with it, that's what I do. I was finally doing it with people that were also doing it. And so after that, I went up to my principal who loved me and said, you know, because we're a language school and everything is focused around languages, we don't have very many arts in this school. And she's like, yes. And I said, I would love to do an after-school drama club. I don't have a background as a drama person. I've only ever done one show, but I think I could do this. And it just so happened that the Japanese teacher, who was my colleague, had done a lot of theater in college. And he said, yeah, I'll partner with him. We'll do it together. And she said, yes. And so I started a drama club and successfully transitioned from being an after-school thing to a curricular thing. It was embedded in the middle school curriculum. And after a few years, it was so hard. But I was really good at being a teacher. I had one teacher of the year. I had become the department head. I had done this drama thing. I started presenting at conferences around the country. And it was just so on the upward trajectory. And I told my principal, I need to quit. And I told my parents, I need to quit. And they were just floored.
How old were you?
I would have been now 26.
Wow.
Around 26. And I said, I have to learn how to do this theater thing correctly. I need to train. I need to not just be making it up and sponging things. I have not had anybody just tell me what's supposed to happen. I wasn't about, though, to go back to an undergraduate. I already had a bachelor's degree, but I also never took a theater class before. I'd never taken an acting class. I had never anything. Like, I knew nothing. I just took a leap of faith, and I applied to a couple of grad programs, and one was one of the best grad programs in the country, Columbia. They take 2 students a year, highly competitive, hundreds of applicants. I got an audition. They whittled it down to a few. I went to New York. Anne Bogart, one of the preeminent directors in the world, held this audition. She's the head of the Columbia directing program. And I auditioned for her, and it was the biggest disaster, the hugest failure I've ever, I mean, for the person that does a lot of things well, this was legitimately one of the worst things I'd ever done. I was among people who had been doing this for years, and I just made a complete fool of myself. It was not cartoons, and it was not Disney. It was art and avant-garde and...
Well, you didn't have any...
I didn't know...
You had no context for it.
Absolutely none.
Right.
But luckily, I had another program that I had applied for. They took... they didn't do an audition. They did an interview and a film reel. And so I had film from the little student productions that I had done. And by then, I had done a few community projects, community theater shows. And they contacted me and said, we need not interview you. We'd like to offer you a spot in the class. And it was in London. So I quit and I moved to London to get an MFA in theater directing. I remember again thinking, okay, what did I get myself into? I'm going to be the worst one in the class because I didn't have any experience academically in this. It was absolutely the right choice. This, most grad schools, the reason they do a couple of students is because for you to practically be able to direct, you have to have access to stages and students and lights and personnel and things. But at this particular program, it was theoretical. You did some practical projects. You did a few amongst yourselves acting things or experimental thing. But for the most part, we sat in a circle and we discussed the theory behind directing. And it's exactly what I needed because I didn't have any of that. But I was starting to be able to articulate making things happen and creating and using humans to do what's in your brain. And we did a whole intensive 6-week modules in Shakespeare, in musical theater, in Stanislavski, in Brecht, in contemporary theater, in how to be an artistic director, the business side of things, all of these different things. But the beauty of the project was that it was constantly guest speakers, constant influx of people. And always the thing that I love is musical theater. And so when it was time for musical theater class, I was so excited. And the guest speaker that came to speak, everything that was coming out of his mouth was what was exactly in my heart. I just thought, oh my God, this is me speaking to me. And I remember filling my notebook with hundreds of gems of quotes that he was speaking. And I remember every person that had walked into the room, they always said things like, you know, when we'd ask, what's the one piece of advice you would give? And they would always say, you need to write to people and just write to them. And you never know when a letter can do something. And we always rolled our eyes and thought that never works. Right. And he said, well, if it were me, I would write. I would recognize the director that you have, you know, a kindred spirit with, the work that you watch that just looks like the kind of work you want to produce, and write to them. And he left, and I thought, I'm going to write to him. And I wrote to him at least twice and emailed him at least twice. And I was very insistent. I was, you know, stalking his every, you know, step. He was the artistic director of the Open Air Theater in London, Timothy Sheeter. And he was about to do a show, which was an adaptation of The Lord of the Flies, which was a cast of children. And I thought, that's my in. Mm-hmm. I have a background with working with children.
Yes, sir.
And I wrote to him and I said exactly that. I said, if you need anybody, I don't know if you have an assistant. I don't know if you need anybody that just to be a child wrangler. I don't know what you need. And he wrote back finally and said, I don't need an assistant. I have a co-director on this production. But you've been very insistent. You can come and we'll have a chat. You can come to my office and we'll chat. So we had a chat. And at the end of it, he's like, yeah, I'm going to say again, I don't need an assistant. But after this chat, I feel compelled to have an assistant. And he hired me as his assistant director on this West End production. And it was such a success that he carried me onto his giant musical. The next show was a musical. He was the foremost director. He was like the director du jour. He had just won back-to-back Olivier Awards for Best Musical Revival. This was his follow-up to these two ginormous successes. It was already going to transfer for a West End open-end run. And he's like, I already have an assistant on this show, but if you really want to be like a second assistant, we can make that. I said, of course.
Like, all right.
And so I was on this show, and since then, really, I've been an assistant to some of the best people in the business. And
my God, you went from nothing
to
everything.
Absolutely, right, right. Absolutely crazy. I came back to America after I graduated. I came back to America, went to a production of West Side Story at the El Paso Opera, and the director did this really wackadoodle concept with it. And I had just come from London where everything was wackadoodle, and wrote to him. I thought, I want another room. I'm going to write again. And he invited me in, and he hired me as his assistant for the next four seasons at the El Paso Opera. And I thought, this is going somewhere. And then I thought, but I need to not do just opera, because now I've only been doing opera, and I want to do other things. And that's when I decided, you still don't have the credentials to become a freelance director, but you should look for a professional assistant job. And I found an advertisement on Playbill.com for a directing fellowship at a company called Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. And I thought, I'm going to go for it. And I applied, and I got the job as directing fellow for the Oslo Rep season. And exactly a year ago, Thanksgiving, I came and I was thrown in the deep end as the first full-fledged directing fellow here. And I was assisting Frank Galati and Peter Amster and Michael Donald Edwards. And the schedule did not allow for me to assist Greg Lemming. But I went up to him and I said, I feel so badly that it didn't work out that you get an assistant. Of all the directors in the season, you don't get an assistant. But I'd love to, whenever I have a chance, I'll come during previews, and I'll sit with you, and I'll take your notes for you. I'll do whatever you need. And he just looked at me and thought, oh, wow, that's super generous, but I'll take you up on that. Sure, why not? And that's how I got my in with Greg. And by the end of the season, everyone was just very pleased with my work here. And Greg found little ways to, I want you to read this play, and I want to see your opinion on this play. And not really knowing that he was kind of thinking of me to direct a show for his conservatory season.
Oh my God.
And he gave me this script for The Liar.
So talk to us about The Liar now.
He had already given me a few scripts. I had given him a few scripts. I knew he was looking for plays for his show, for his season, and I had worked with all the students that are my second years this year, that were my first years last year. As a directing fellow, I worked with them as my understudy company for all of the reps season shows. So I had a rapport with them already. And he gave me this script for The Liar. He's like, okay, so we've been back and forth. Here's this one script. And I read it in 45 minutes. And I jumped on my laptop and I emailed him and I said, this is brilliant. This is brilliant. It's particularly perfect for this class. It's particularly perfect for training students. I just gushed about it. It was never implied that I would do it.
No.
It was just, what do you think about this play? And I just thought, oh, wow, Greg, you've got to do this. And so he wrote back and he's like, yeah, I think you're right. We're going to do it and I want you to do it. And I was just like, well, then, sure. Sure. I mean, of course, I'm not going to say no. So it's an absolute gem of a show. It is hilarious. It is bubbly and effervescent. And it's perfect for students who are training.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely perfect. It's a beautiful play. David Ives is a contemporary playwright who, he says, translaptated, which is a half translation, half adaptation, a play from the 1640s by Pierre Corneille, France, called Le Menteur, which is The Liar, that was always considered a classic theater farce, but it's never done. And so he was approached by the Shakespeare Theater Company in D.C. to translate it and adapt it. And he absolutely loved it, but he really did take liberties with it. And his biggest thing was that he wrote it in verse, a verse Shakespearean sounding piece, all rhyming couplets, but he used a lot of modern vernacular and idioms, studying it with this hilarious modern cell phone and cool and, you know, all these interesting anachronisms, and he just made it even more funny than the original, which was already funny, but he knew that it needs to speak to the modern, audiences, and if I had been in the audience back when the play was originally done, it was a coup, and so I needed to be equally a coup today in English. He really did nail it. And what I particularly love is that it centers around a character who has the most purely joyous experience inventing and creating lies. And as a director and all my actors in my cast, I told them on day one, we are professional liars. We are training to become
better and
the
better
next
at
generation
it.
Of professional liars. And that's what we do for a living right now. And that's what we're studying, to put on fake stories, put on fake characters. We love doing this. We love lying. Mm-hmm. And in this particular play, the lies are never malicious. They're fun. And we went through, you know, a thesaurus and talked about all the definitions and synonyms of to lie, and the centerpiece one is to act. And so I told them, we're going to approach it that way. We are all going to enjoy lying and really go for reveling inventing lies. So I'm so excited. They're such a great group, and we've gone through every word of the script already, and we've uncovered so much about what goes into lying and why we're so drawn as a human race to fabricating things. It's such a natural thing to do. I read to them Genesis 3 and Genesis 4, the story of the serpent and Adam and Eve, and the story of Cain and Abel, and showed that even in our oral history, the first dramatic moment that we're exposed to was the story of deceit and lies. And it's inescapable, and it could be hurtful and horrible, and we grow up thinking that you're going to burn in hell for lying, but it's fun too, and it can lead to really hilarious, you know, antics, which is what this entire play is full of.
It's wonderful. Yeah. It's wonderful. I interviewed Scott and Kelly.
Okay.
Are they both in it?
They are both in it.
Yes, because they both talked about it, right?
Yes. In fact, Scott is the liar.
Is the liar, yeah.
He will be the liar.
And he was amazing in
The Actor's Nightmare.
So I'm really looking forward to, he was a great liar.
Of course.
The Actor's Nightmare. He was a great liar. This has been just amazing. So I just want to thank you.
I thank you. This is a therapy for me now that I'm putting all the, you know, through line of my life to where I am now.
You were meant to do this.
I think so.
And I think your story describes that. You know, I mean, you got knocked off course.
Right.
A couple of times. But when you saw it, you knew it.
Yeah.
And you had the courage to go for it. And listening to you, it's very clear. You are who you are, and you're doing what you were meant to do. And it's rare. It's rare. So many people, even if they know it the way you knew it, get knocked off course, and then they never get back.
That's true.
So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. So, are you living the life that you were meant to live? Have you had the experience of knowing some things about you, having a passionate connection to some way of being? It doesn't have to be a skill or an activity or an art. It could be a way of being in the world. It could be a really quirky sense of humor, which they managed to tease you so much about that you've given it up. It may be that you're a person with a really outrageous laugh, which again, you got teased about, and so now you resist laughing out loud. Or maybe you love to sing, and somebody told you that you didn't sing well, or that you were off key, or that it didn't sound good. And so now you don't give yourself the pleasure. Not just that you didn't want to become a professional singer, but that you lost the capacity to enjoy this thing which is part of you. So did any of these things happen to you? Can you say, like Justin, I am doing what I love doing, what I always wanted to do? Well, if this resonated with you, if this sounded familiar to you, So many of us feel like we're frauds. There's something about us that's we're not expressing. And maybe if we did, somebody wouldn't like it. If any of this seems true to you, please know that it's not too late to recover what you may have had to sacrifice. And again, I would be happy to talk to you about that. If you want to, you find me at my website, thelinshow.com. So as always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use, something that inspired you, something that's going to make you come out and see the liar, because don't we all want to see Justin's directorial debut and cheer him on? And let me tell you, if you didn't see The Actor's Nightmare, seeing Scott is worth coming out for. In any case, something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got